From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Ron Bergman is grateful that Netflix gave Glass Onion a theatrical run, even though it was just for a week on only 600-odd screens. But the Israeli producer hopes that the experiment will move the needle.
Believe me, I'm not going to argue. Of course, I would want the movie to be in 3,000 screens, but I recognize what Netflix is. You know, it's a step. And who knows, depending how this goes, what it means for other movies or other streamers in the future. I think everybody's going to be looking at this experiment.
Ron Bergman talks about the beginnings of his fruitful partnership with director Rian Johnson, the surprising amount of freedom Disney gave them on The Last Jedi, and without disclosing numbers, he shares why the Netflix Knives Out deal was really, really good, about $500 million worth of good. But first we banter, stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, of course, we're going to talk about Disney. Disney has attracted the attention of corporate raiders, two 80-year-olds. This isn't the first time Disney has attracted corporate raider attention. When Bob Chapek was the CEO during that relatively short tenure, Dan Loeb, another difficult and well-known dissident shareholder, approached. They worked out a deal. And Dan Loeb said, okay, I'll let it go for now and keep an eye on you, I assume. Then Nelson Peltz, who has been around for decades, emerged. And he started this when Bob Chapek was still in the chair. It only came to light after Bob Chapek had been fired and Bob Iger returned. So what might have seemed a compelling argument, and Nelson Peltz is saying, I should be on the board. You haven't really worked out succession. All this litany of issues that he wants to bring up. Some of those felt very compelling when Chapek was on the job and there were multiple missteps. But Peltz came forward just after Iger had been reinstated and Disney was rejoicing and the street felt better and, you know, the investors felt better. So his timing is kind of weird, but he's not giving it up. And he has, it turns out, a sidekick in all of this, Ike Perlmutter, who had sold Marvel Entertainment to Disney and ultimately was kind of pushed out of the line of decision-making. First, when then-Marvel film chief Kevin Feige was told he would no longer report to Ike Perlmutter. And then Feige completed his control in 2019 over the other aspects of Marvel Entertainment. So Ike Perlmutter, who had been this dominant person in the Disney world, is Nelson Peltz's friend, his neighbor in Palm Beach. They both worked to elect Trump. They both sent turkeys to the Salvation Army at Thanksgiving a few years ago through their foundations. That's among other charitable endeavors that they have joined forces in. And Nelson Peltz is one thing. He's been more like doing Procter & Gamble and the Wendy's fast food chain. So people were kind of like, what is he even doing in this space? But then when it turns out that Ike Perlmutter is in the game as well, you understand what's going on.
Yeah, you can kind of see these guys sitting around at Mar-a-Lago or wherever in Palm Beach and sort of stewing over this. And Ike is still furious over how he was treated at Disney, considers Iger a nemesis. So he's got a buddy now, and he's willing to buy up $900 million of shares of Disney and cause trouble for them. And that's really what this is. I mean, if you read his presentation to the board, I mean, there's not a lot of things he's asking for that Disney isn't already doing. Yeah, okay, they could spend less. Well, they say they're making cuts soon. Yeah, they could work on succession. Well, they have a new committee that is designed to pick a successor for Bob Iger. Whether it's lip service or not, we'll see soon. Yeah, and they could figure out their streaming strategy. That's his whole job right now. Iger is trying to figure out what their streaming strategy is going to be going forward. So I don't really know what it is Peltz wants other than to be allowed on the board. So Disney kind of rightfully, in my opinion, said, you know what, we're not going to do that.
Yeah, I mean, the irony here is that this fight will be an expensive distraction for Disney, which is definitely arming itself to the teeth. And at a time when, as you say, Bob Iger is trying to solve these problems.
Yeah, he's trying to solve the problems. And this is not the narrative that he wants. He wants to be talking about how he got Marvel movies back into China after a 3-year ban, essentially, on those movies. He wants to be talking about how he's got a plan for the future. And now he's got these activist shareholders litigating the past, saying, oh, he shouldn't have done the Fox deal. $71 billion was too expensive. Well, okay, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. They did get the Avatar franchise, which is currently about to hit $2 billion globally. If they didn't buy Fox, then Comcast likely would have. And we'd be talking about The Simpsons being on Peacock and all of the growth that Peacock is having, other than now we're talking about all the growth at Disney Plus, and they've got all these other things that came from the Fox deal, but fine, we can litigate that. It's just not what Iger wants to be talking about. I don't think this is going to go anywhere with the shareholders when they vote in March, but the real problem here is 6-8 months from now, when Nelson Peltz is still on a soapbox talking about all the problems at Disney, and if the stock hasn't recovered by then Iger will have a problem, because this guy will then have an argument to say, well, I've been talking about this for a while and you're not listening to me. Maybe you should listen to me.
Yeah, and I will note that another thing Nelson Peltz did not acknowledge is that the problems that Disney is facing right now are these problems that all the legacy media companies are facing. It is rough going out there, and Nelson Peltz did not acknowledge that at all. So I think we both agree that the Disney shareholders are going to be like, no way, we're not going to vote you a seat on the board. We're going to back Bob Iger. But again, last thing that Bob Iger really needs right now. So we'll see how long this goes on and whether somebody else emerges in all of this. But right now, it's just a real kind of old school tale, it feels like, of vengeance and ego. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Balany, a founding partner of Puck News. Ron Bergman has been on a steady rise for the better part of the past 3 decades. He started out producing micro-budget films in the 90s and was happy doing that until 2002, when an ambitious young filmmaker named Ryan Johnson caught his attention. Their partnership has grown since Bergman produced Johnson's 2005 debut movie, Brick, which garnered critical attention and a special jury prize at Sundance. Together, they've made films including the 2008 caper comedy, The Brothers Bloom, the 2012 sci-fi action thriller Looper, and a project called Star Wars: The Last Jedi. In 2019, Bergman and Johnson released Knives Out, a fresh comedic mystery starring Daniel Craig, with an ensemble cast too long to list. Made for a mid-level budget, the film mopped up $313 million at the box office. Netflix shelled out almost $500 million for 2 sequels, the first of which was Glass Onion, with Craig reprising his role as Detective Benoit Blanc. The story begins at the height of the pandemic, when a group of friends gets a mysterious invitation delivered to the various places where they are riding out the shutdown. The members of the group, played by Katherine Hahn, Leslie Odom Jr., Kate Hudson, and Dave Bautista, phone each other upon receiving it.
My dear friends, my beautiful disruptors, my closest inner circle.
We could all use a moment of normalcy, and so you are cordially invited.
For a long weekend on my private island!
Where we will celebrate the bonds that connect us, and I hope your puzzle-solving skills are whetted. Ah!
Because you will also be competing to solve the mystery
of my murder. Travel details to come. Please forward any dietary restrictions. Love and all my kisses, Miles.
Our guest today, producer Ron Bergman, was born and raised in Israel. He moved to the States in 1990, hoping to break into the movies. His approach was unconventional, but calculated. You obviously are from Israel, so we know that. You got interested in movies, and you came here. You were a valet?
Sure was. I came here when I arrived from Israel. I had a dream of making movies, but I really didn't know how you make movies. And got to New York, found a job as a PA on 2 movies, hated it with passion. And I said, this is not for me. I wanted to find something that even in 20 years, I didn't make it. I would still have the passion to do it. And I didn't know what it was. Mm. And then I came to LA. My brother moved to LA and he's a musician. And I came here and I was just hanging. And then after 2 months, realized, okay, I think I want to make movies. Found another job as a PA on a movie, like $200,000 movie, and really enjoyed it and said, you know what? I don't want to climb the ladder. I just want to go and produce. I don't really know how you produce. But I also realized that a lot of people in this town came from everywhere with a dream. And they all started like, you know, whether they want to write or produce or direct, they felt that they should start as assistant. And then they would climb the ladder and will get another job, and they would get paid more. Cut to 10 years later, they have a family, they have everything, and they forgot what they really came here for. So I realized I should just find a job that will not be in the business, because also once you work in the business and you work on a set, you work for 14, 15 hours a day, and you don't really have the time to develop your script or write a script or, you know, pursue your girl.
Sucks all your energy out of you.
So I decided I should find a job that's going to be flexible, will pay me as minimum as possible, but allow me the time to figure out how you get movies made. So I found a job as a valet, making like $4 an hour.
And a year later, plus tips.
Plus tips. In fact, my last tip was a $100 tip.
Wow, a good valet.
Just took the money and walked out.
That was it.
And that's how I left. I said, somebody was tipping me $100. That's probably a sign I should not do it again. And
I think a lot of people would say it's a sign you should do it. Were there extra services involved here?
No extra services.
I feel I must ask. Okay.
And then a year later, I was producing first movie and then slowly start producing, a lot of low budget movies.
You're starting out in that American film market, low end. Yes. And some people get stuck there.
I loved going to the markets. I loved going to the AFM. I loved going to Milan, to London, to all those, because you met all the international buyers. And you realized how movies get sold. And as a producer, I realized, okay, if I have a project, I know how to put it together. I understand, I can call these buyers, I can call this buyer, I can figure out what the value of the movie is, and then reverse engineering the movie, which is kind of essentially what I did for years. And I got to say, all that experience paid off in a meaningful way. Until today, we're putting movies with Ryan.
Right, right. So, well, fast forward to you meeting Ryan Johnson, which I'm not quite sure. I know you worked on that first film, Brick, in 2005, all the way back in 2000.
We shot it in 2003.
Oh, okay.
We released it in Sundance. I mean, we premiered it in Sundance 2005, yeah.
And you got a nice special jury prize and lots of acclaim. But where did you guys meet?
So a friend of mine sent me the script for Brick. And I read it and I was like blown away.
Right.
And I said, I want to meet this guy. And at that point, Ryan had been trying to make the movie for about 7 years, unsuccessfully. I think he took the usual route where he had other producer and he was trying to make the movie for $3 million. And he was trying to cast, like, name young cast. And when I met him, I said to him, listen, this movie is very ambitious. I don't believe anybody will let you make this movie. If you continue the same route in 7 years from now, you still won't make the movie. The only way for you to do it is make the movie for practically nothing.
$330,000.
This way you can control the distribution of the movie and you control how you make the movie. The more money you're going to make the movie, you will have people who will interfere with either your process or will interfere with what you end up doing with the movie when you finished it. And he said, do you think we can make the movie? And I said, yeah, I'm sure we can. If we want to, we'll figure it out. So we spend months and months talking about it. And eventually we decide he went and raised money from his family. And we went and made the movie for $330,000.
Yeah, so I think he said he was comfortable because he taking money from his family to do the movie because he felt that you would make a movie and make it happen.
Listen, at that point, I've made plenty of low-budget movies and some bigger movies, but I realized after the first setup on the set that he knew what he was doing. He didn't really need me. He was, like, so clear, and he knew what he wanted, and he knew how to communicate it to the small crew that we have in the cast. And I said, my life is going to be easy. And it was something I haven't experienced before. So, yeah, that was it.
That was it. And so then there's some starts and stops. It's not all just like rocket to the moon. But you start this company, T Street, in 2019, just in time for the pandemic. And I'm going to fast forward, I think, to The Last Jedi. You've talked about shielding Ryan from interference. The Star Wars movies, as I have covered myself in agonizing detail, it's been a I must want to say violent thing for some. They've gone through a number of directors and some of them have gotten tied to a chair and allowed to keep the title. And some of them have been just dumped in the middle, a couple. How did you find it? Did you have to run interference?
No.
Be honest with me.
No. I'll be honest. And I think if you ask anybody from inside, it will tell you that our experience have been phenomenal. We were like, I don't want to say we were the only one, but we were like really at like the smoothest experience ever. And I think one of the reasons is we started just when JJ started filming his first movie, Episode 7.
JJ Abrams, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Ryan had the draft of the script, first draft, pretty much when JJ finished filming. And the draft was really good and everybody responded super positive all the way from Bob to the Ellens to Kathy. There was universally...
Kennedy, yeah, Alan Bergman, Alan Horn, all correct, the hierarchy then.
Correct. And they all loved it. And basically, that's the script that I would say 85% that we went to shoot. So from that moment on, we had essentially a year to prep the movie. And Ryan, again, is essentially the auteur who's making small movies, big movies. He knew exactly what he wanted to the details, and he was able to communicate it to everybody. So by the time we went to do the movie, it felt to us like it's like we're making Brick. A lot of the people who are working the movie are our friends, people we've been working with since Brick. And it just
not
didn't
330,000, of course.
Correct. So a lot more zeros, but yeah, the process felt significantly more. There was zero interference. Nobody asked us to change or do anything. Even if there were things that maybe they didn't agree with, they were completely embraced it.
Okay, fine. The interview's done here.
Yes.
We'll go home.
I don't know.
I mean, I think it's amazing. It's such tricky terrain because the thing about Star Wars, I've talked about it on the show multiple times, there's such a template. It's not like Kevin Feige inventing Marvel. Everybody has seen the George Lucas films and they have this mythology in their head. And if you stay too close to it, it's the same old. And if you change it too much, they have a breakdown. It's like threading a needle.
Absolutely. And for whatever the reason, I can't say why, they all bought into Ryan's vision.
Well, congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you.
Apparently, you have a way of, I'm reading you a quote, which will have to be bleeped. I'll make sure that nobody's going to be there to f*** with us, but that doesn't mean you can't do it in the nicest way.
I think both Ryan and I are nice, except Ryan is way nicer than me. Oh. Ryan is the nicest human being you could ever meet.
Okay.
I think I'm nice, but not as nice as Ryan. But I think we're very direct from day one. So this is our process of how we make the movies. So far, all our experiences have been great experiences. We really didn't have anything, any bad experience. And I think one of the reasons is everybody is bought into it. And we've been very upfront and said, this is the process. This is how we're going to go in. And also the way we have, with the exception of Star Wars, structured the movies in terms of how we get them financed. All our movies, even including the last one, they have been independently. Ryan writes the script, we develop it, we put the cast together. We go and make deal like last minute.
Right.
We're not asking anybody to finance our development. We're not, you know, we just, in fact, in the last two Knives Out, we finance it ourselves. So when you do it and you go to the financiers in the last minute, a lot of it is already made or prepared. So I'm saying, this is the movie. Do you guys want to come join us or not? You know, that's how it works.
Coming up after the break, Ron Bergman talks about Netflix's experimental theatrical release of Glass Onion and why he thinks other streamers might decide to do even more. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Producer Ron Bergman has collaborated with writer-director Rian Johnson on all of Johnson's six feature films, including a venture into the Star Wars universe with 2017's The Last Jedi. Their success with the 2019 comedic mystery Knives Out led to a bidding war for two sequels. Netflix prevailed and gave the first of those films, Glass Onion, a brief and limited theatrical release before whisking it onto the streamer. In Glass Onion, tech billionaire Miles Braun, played by Edward Norton, outlines the rules of a sinister murder mystery game that he's planned for his closest friends. There's also a surprise guest, Daniel Craig's detective Benoit Blanc, of course.
Any questions?
What are we wearing?
What do you want?
No, nothing. I just thought maybe there was a prize or something. an iPad or like.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Yeah, no, the winner gets an iPad.
The original Knives Out was made by an entity called T Street, which came into existence when our guest, Ron Bergman, and his partner, Ryan Johnson, teamed up with Media Rights Capital, or MRC. MRC is an independent production company run by partners Modi Wichik and Asif Sachu. Bergman says the arrangement came about thanks to two of MRC's film execs, Jonathan Goldman and Bry Adler, who spent years courting him and Johnson. After the original Knives Out turned into a breakout hit, there was an auction for two sequels. MRC lost out when Netflix ponied up $450 million for two movies. So T Street, you had an investor, MRC. And I should be transparent. MRC ran The Hollywood Reporter, those guys, Modi and Asif, mostly Modi. And I think they still have a little part of us, but they're not present, thankfully, in our lives anymore. But I need you to sort of walk me through. They became an investor. They are the ones who went out with Knives Out, right, initially?
So
I don't have this figured out.
Here's what happened. So when Ryan was working on the script on Knives Out, we set a date that we're going to shoot the movie on October 29, 2018. The intention was always to go and pre-sell the foreign territories and then pre-sell the U.S. rights, and that's how we were going to finance the movie.
It's the old Harvey Weinstein model.
It's before Harvey was Harvey.
Run it, right?
Yes,
and now before, it sounds bad. Yeah, but
no, it's essentially how, you know, you could own the movie 100%.
Right.
And play on the upside, or in a way you might have less of an upside, but you can keep ownership of the movie. And we end up getting Daniel attached like 8 weeks or 7.5 weeks before.
Which was a stroke of luck, I think, because the Bond movie got postponed.
Exactly. Danny Boyle's movie fell apart. So
yeah, and you didn't even know who you were going to have.
We had no idea who we were going to cast.
So you get this last minute incredible thing.
Correct. And we are clearly at that point prepping the movie. We get Daniel, and then MRC for years, Modi
Wichik.
And predominantly Jonathan and Brian run the film side have been pursuing working with Ryan and myself. And, you know, I already said, I'll get you the script when I know what the movie is, know who is in the movie and what it is, but I don't really see us working together because this is the route I'm going to go. And, you know, once we had Daniel and we were heading to go to Toronto, we gave the script to Jonathan and Brian, and then with 24 hours, they made us an offer that was like, okay, this is a great offer with people who clearly want to be in business with us. And we end up making the movie, had a great experience. Movie becomes a success.
Right.
And some of those people, like Jonathan Bry, through the process became really good friends. And, you know, we start talking about how we can produce other movies and doing TV stuff. So we end up working on a partnership where they invested just an amount of money in the company. And we had a first look deal for us on film and TV on stuff that was not written and directed by Ryan. And I got to say that I don't know what your experience have been, but
don't get me started. We'll leave that for another day.
Our experience have been nothing but fantastic. Even though we decided to go make the deal with Netflix, those guys could not have been more supportive of us. I'm sure they were sad in one way, but really,
really sad.
But really happy for us.
We're jumping ahead to let's stay with the first film for a while.
Yeah.
So they invest with you as a broader partnership.
Yeah. But that's after the first movie.
Lionsgate?
So then MRC committed to financing fully the movie. And then we knew we had to find a distributor. And we basically got Lionsgate just like a week before we started filming. We made a deal with Lionsgate to distribute the movie. And you realize that for Lionsgate, they wanted the movie more than anyone else. You could see from the meeting, they brought everyone to the meeting and basically treated it like it's going to be their Star Wars. It was obvious to Ryan and myself, it was obvious to MRC. We should go with Lionsgate.
This movie is a big hit, Mazel Tov.
Thank you.
Then the idea of the sequel arises, and I'm not quite clear how it doesn't stay with MRC.
Because when we structured the deal, the way the deal was, it was essentially one picture deal.
As a keep our options open deal.
Like I said, because the way we were going to do it, we were going to finance it, we were going to control it. But I mean, I would say that, you know, when we went into it, our intention was to go make the movie with Lionsgate and MRC. You know, when we were there, like it's like 2020, you're in the midst of COVID. Really, you had no idea what the landscape would look like 2 years from then. we said, okay, we also should probably test the market. And we got an offer from Netflix that basically we couldn't say no.
The numbers that were kicked around on the press are very big. A potential upside for you, for Ryan, for Daniel Craig, $100 million each. That's gigantic.
You're not going to get me to comment on that.
Well, you can't blame me for trying. I mean, can you say whether it's realistic at all? Or
I would say
the island.
The deals are...
They're really good.
The deals are really good.
Really good.
But I would also say that the experience have been also really good.
They pretty much let you do your thing.
Yeah. They basically support us however we need. But basically, we go do the movie. We are essentially the studio and we deliver the movie. But they're really happy with how it turned out and happy with the reaction. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
We will see what happens. I mean, one of the things with Netflix, I mean, first of all, they have a lot going on, so they probably have many other things to worry about than you and Rian Johnson making this film, because you guys seem to know what you're doing. The question of theatrical, you didn't build anything in about theatrical.
We always, you know, there was something, but nothing so meaningful like what it ended up being. But, you know, upfront, we want the movie to be in theaters. But honestly, we had no idea what theaters would be like when we made the deal, what theatrical would look like. Honestly, I said, we'll revisit it when we finish the movie or when we're in post-production or whatever, see what the world looks like. But yeah, we definitely wanted the movie to be in theaters. And, you know, we also recognized that Ted and Netflix, you know, they know what they are. Do they though?
I mean, Ted Sarandos has...
I think he believed... I mean, he basically... it's a streaming service first and foremost.
Right. That's what he thinks. Yes. But I think there are maybe other people at Netflix. In fact, I know that there may be other people at Netflix who believed this would go wider and longer in theaters, and it didn't happen.
I've no doubt that there's plenty of people who wanted it to go wider. But I think at the end of the day...
Ted wins.
This is Ted. He runs the company and he knows what he and Reed have built. And it's first and foremost a streaming service. I would say, you know, whatever they're doing at the moment, like with our release, they are doing things outside of their comfort zone.
Yes.
They are spending money to market the movie like they've never done before. So believe me, I'm not going to argue. Of course, I would want the movie to be in 3,000 screens, but I recognize what Netflix is and who they are. And, you know, it's a step. And, you know, who knows, depending how this goes, you know, what it means for other movies or other streamers in the future. I think everybody's going to be looking at this experiment.
What, it's for two sequels, right?
Yeah.
You already at work on the second one?
Well, no. Ryan started thinking about it, but in reality, he's been so busy like promoting the movie.
Yeah.
And I think once movie's out and whatever, he'll take a few weeks break and start working, you know, start working.
It must
working
be quite a process because it is like creating a puzzle.
Yeah. He spent so many months just on his notebook and just trying to basically come up with an outline before he go and writes anything. But the thing is that clearly we don't want to repeat the first movie or the second movie. So every time you make another movie, it's going to become more of a challenge and more of a challenge. How do you not repeat yourself when you do something that's still good and fun and surprise people and delight them? So it's going to be a challenge, but I'm counting on him.
I think that sounds like a pretty reasonable bet. Ron Bergman produced Glass Onion, A Knives Out Mystery. The film is available to stream on Netflix now. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from PJ Shahamat, Katie Gilchrist, and Matt Schwartz, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.